On this week's 51%, a number of groups call on former Vice President Joe Biden to choose a woman of color as his VP. A doctor in India talks about COVID-19.
As climate change happens, as we change the environment that we live in, I think we are just going to see more and more viruses coming into human populations. Many will be asymptomatic. Many will die out.
And Dr. Jerry Burns returns with an essay on life amid a pandemic. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. March 15th debate between Democratic presidential primary candidates former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, Biden made a commitment that made headlines.
If I'm elected president, have an opportunity to appoint someone to the courts, I'll appoint the first black woman to the courts. It's required that they have representation now. It's long overdue. Secondly, if I'm elected president, my cabinet, my administration will look like the country. And I commit that I will, in fact, pick a woman to be vice president. There are a number of women who are qualified to be president tomorrow. I would pick a woman to be my vice president.
Steve Phillips wants to hear Biden go a step further. He's the founder of Democracy in Color, which spearheaded a letter with She the People, signed by 8 other groups, to Biden and Sanders, asking them to commit to picking a woman of color to serve as vice president. Democracy in Color is a national organization working at the intersection of race and politics, and She the People, a national network of women of color in politics. Sanders said he would most likely choose a woman as his VP. Now, by the time this interview hits the airwaves, it is possible the call goes out to Biden alone, as Biden swept the 3 states holding primaries March 17th, and Sanders was reassessing his campaign at that point. And perhaps Biden has already named his VP candidate. Still, I spoke with Phillips about Biden's commitment and the letter.
I thought that was a good first step, that he was committing to actually choosing a woman after, tiptoeing around the issue. And then I want him to take the next step, which is to commit that that woman will be a woman of color. So we worked with a number of groups to send a letter to Biden and Sanders' campaigns, urging them to take the step to formally and firmly commit to their vice presidential nominee being a woman of color. I did a column there in The Nation, really similarly challenging them to make that commitment and really highlighting how some of the fears and hesitance to do that really is a legacy of all the attacks on affirmative action over the years, that there's more of a fear of alienating white male voters than there is an imperative to inspire voters of color, and that still dominates Democratic politics.
Let's say Joe Biden becomes the Democratic presidential nominee. He selects a woman of color. Is that person going to draw more voters to the voting booth?
Yes. I mean, the people unfortunately skip over some of the most basic data points and facts that we have. The most fundamentally is that the Democrats have not won the White House with an all-white ticket for over 20 years. And that's a lesson that, unfortunately, Hillary Clinton did not internalize and understand. And that really a lot of what happened there was the enthusiasm gap is that people were not inspired and motivated, and black turnout fell off a cliff in 2016. And so that was a key part of why she lost Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So having a ticket that has somebody who comes from those communities, inspires people, and they can see themselves in that leadership is a critical component of leadership. And it's something that I hope that they grasp. And I would add that also Biden in particular, having a young woman of color, and his numbers with young people are atrocious, even like 16%, 19% in these exit polls. So he needs somebody who can inspire and galvanize younger people as well, almost half of whom are people of color.
So anyone in mind, any names being bandied about or, that come to your mind that would make sense in that capacity? And define young.
Right. Well, sadly, this election, under 77 is one way to put it. But I think clearly you're looking at people most likely probably in their 40s. And the person who stands out most dramatically in a lot of ways is Stacey Abrams out of Georgia. that she has an incredible track record of garnering and improving and increasing voters of color, young people, African-American voters. She got more votes in Georgia than Barack Obama got when he ran. She won the youth vote in Georgia, which Obama did not do when he ran. And then she's very tapped in also to popular culture. She's on like LeBron James's TV show. She's written romance novels. So there's an element of her identity that I think is more resonant with a younger generation. So she's top of mind for certainly, I think, for me and for a lot of other people. But there are other people, right? People talk about, you know, Kamala Harris, there's Tammy Duckworth out of Illinois, there's Michelle Lujan Grisham out of the governor of New Mexico. There's a long line of talented women of color, which is why there should be no hesitance to make a commitment. It's not that there's a pool they can't find somebody from. And so if they have that belief, then they should just go out and say it will be one of those talented women of color.
Then who is that woman if it's Bernie Sanders?
Well, I also think that that's actually part of the appeal of Stacey Abrams, is that she appeals to the progressive wing as well. I mean, she actually was on the board, I think, of Move On in a younger phase for her life and whatnot. And she has said she would be happy and willing to serve with whomever. It's unusual, too, to be able to say that she's not going to be coy about that. So there's that. I mean, the interesting thing about Bernie is a lot of his most prominent supporters are young, and so young that they couldn't be vice president. Right? So Andrea Ocasio-Cortez is only 30 years old. She had to be 35 to be vice president, so she would be a logical choice in the natural course of things.
You know, how did we get to men in their late 70s to white men? How did we get there when the Democratic presidential primary stage looked a lot deeper earlier on?
Yeah, no, it's something we had distributed a report and a podcast episode we called The White Man's Bump. And it's really an unexpected further consequence of having someone as racist and misogynist as Trump in the White House, and I guess, and also beating a woman in 2016, is that because conventional wisdom has deeply taken place where people feel that the only way to beat Trump is to have a white guy. And so that's actually played itself out in the polls, where they actually were saying, you think it'd be easier or harder for a woman, for a white man, or for a person of color to win. And you can see demonstrably the penalty in terms of the electability of calculation that people are doing when looking at a woman and looking at voters of color, looking at candidates of color. And so that electability penalty is ultimately played a big, big role in dooming the candidates of Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Tony Castro, and the full diverse slate, leaving us with to late 70s white guys.
Is there an advantage or disadvantage to going for one of the former candidates on stage? You mentioned Kamala Harris. You know, we talk about Stacey Abrams, then we're confined, both with Biden and Sanders, to the East Coast. That leaves out, obviously, a big portion of the country.
Yeah, I think that there's multiple configurations and elements people have to look at. Looking at how the voting history has played out across the country, there are African Americans across the country that, in all, because of the way the history has worked out, and so the black vote is very strategically important in multiple different places. And so Detroit, Milwaukee, Philadelphia could have delivered the White House to Clinton if she'd had higher African American turnout in that regard. So you have that issue. So it really expands geography. Demography kind of trumps, or not that word, demography kind of is more important than geography in some sense in that regard. And I've heard the thing about having somebody who had run for president this last time. I don't think that at the end of the day, certainly when the voters go to the polls in November, is going to be a fundamental criterion. It's really going to be more about the person's track record, their identity, their appeal to the constituency that you want to turn out.
Is the country ready? If we've taken steps back, is the country ready for a mixed race ticket?
Yeah, see, that I think that is partly how we got to the situation where we have this of old white guys being the surviving candidates. This is this electorate will be the most racially diverse electorate in the history of this country. There have been 16 million people who have turned 18 since Trump won in 2016. Half of them are people of color. And people keep forgetting that Clinton won the election by 3 million votes. And it was 78,000 people in three states. And a big part of that was the splintering people going to third and fourth parties. So, yes, the country is ready. I like to say it gets browner by the hour in terms of the demographic transformation. That the 7,000 net increase every day of people of color in America versus a 1,000 net increase of whites. So there are a lot of people who are not ready, but those are not the majority of people, the majority of voters. So if everybody turns out and there's high turnout and people are unified and not splintering the third and fourth parties, the Democratic nominee should defeat this president who does not have and has never had the support of the majority of people.
Not to mention this wild card we're in right now with this pandemic and how long
Absolutely.
This lasts and what happens. I mean, this could change everything, in many
true.
Ways.
There is actually another point I think that people do need to keep their eye on is that there are some people, I think with some justification, have some suspicion around Biden's specificity about putting a black woman on the Supreme Court, and that there's concern. I touched on this in my Nathan column that that's a way to try to soften the blow for him to not choose a person of color as his vice presidential ticket. And so that there's a lot of suspicion that he wants to have Amy Klobuchar, who's much more moderate, et cetera. And so that is in the air, and that would be just from an electoral standpoint, as we saw in 2016, having an all-white ticket doesn't work. And it will be important for people to send that message that the Democrats have to have a desegregated, diversified ticket.
Steve Phillips is the founder of Democracy in Color and author of the New York Times bestselling book, Brown is the New White. New Zealand lawmakers have voted in favor of a landmark bill that treats abortion as a health issue rather than a crime. Until the March 18th vote, women were required to prove to a doctor that their pregnancy presented a danger to their physical or mental health before they could get an abortion. Justice Minister Andrew Little says that forced most women to lie and caused unnecessary delays, which added health risks. The new law allows women up to 20 weeks pregnant to get an abortion and those over 20 weeks to get one with approval from a health practitioner. The global outbreak of COVID-19 keep us apart in more ways than just physically? Sandeep Roy brings us perspective from India for KALW.
My friend Milena Markov had just landed in Kolkata from Dubai. She had braced herself for a nightmare upon arrival. The Indian Health Ministry had just mandated new checks at the airport.
Upon arrival at Kolkata Airport, I was handed two health forms to fill out. And everyone was scrambling for a countertop and a pen to get that sorted.
Then came the screening with separate queues for Indians, foreigners, and people coming from non-affected countries.
There was a thermal heat scan, and if you passed that, you handed in the forms, which were looked over and stamped.
But the bigger nightmare lay outside the airport. Her Uber driver asked her where she was flying in from.
When I told him Dubai, then he said, well, in that case, I'm not going to turn on the AC because I will catch the disease from you.
If she had flown in from Mumbai or Delhi, it would be no problem, he told her.
Dubai is outside of India, so there's infection there.
Welcome to Kolkata in a time of corona. This is Sandeep Roy. Compared to the rest of the world, India has fewer corona cases. It just reached three figures. Whether that's luck or lack of testing is still unclear. Some Indians insist Hinduism has built-in safeguards. Indians do namaste with folded hands instead of shaking hands. For Hindus, cows are sacred animals. Some insist cow dung and cow urine have properties to tackle many illnesses. There are cow urine parties happening in some parts to ward off the coronavirus, as reported on Voice of America. Most Indians, though, are sticking to face masks last used when pollution was high. The country is trying to seal itself off against the virus. It's not just Milena's checks at the airport. India has cancelled visas till mid-April. Telecom providers have health messages instead of ringtones.
Issued in the public interest by the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare, Government of India. Novel coronavirus disease spread can be stopped. Always cover mouth with handkerchief or tissue while coughing and sneezing. Wash your hands with soap frequently. Avoid touching your eyes, nose and mouth.
Others have claimed Indians just have natural immunity because they live exposed to so many kinds of viruses. Dr. Gagandeep Kang, the executive director of the Translational Health Service and Technology Institute in Faridabad, is not so sure.
The SARS coronavirus 2 is a new virus. So there is no reason, unless it was circulating undetected among us, that we should have antibodies and therefore protection against that.
But rumors are flying wild. Chicken sales have plummeted because of fake news that birds can spread corona. Chinese restaurants have seen their business slump. Schools have shut down. Bollywood has ground to a halt. Film shoots have been postponed. The virus has revealed a great civilizational gap. The West prepares for it like an approaching hurricane. They hoard toilet paper. India hoards hand sanitizers and masks and misinformation. But we need to get used to viruses like corona being the norm and not the exception, says Kang.
As climate change happens, as we change the environment that we live in, I think we are just going to see more and more viruses coming into human populations. Many will be asymptomatic, many will die out, but a few will take hold, and even fewer of those will cause disease.
This new reality of social distancing is tough in a country like India, built on social connections. The malls in Kolkata are still open, though in some cities they have shut down. There's just someone at the entrance squirting hand sanitizer at you. At least it's not cow urine. But it all goes to show the panic that an unseen enemy can induce in us. This is an emergency from which we cannot mark ourselves safe on Facebook. When SARS and Ebola and bird flu were spreading, we still did not live in such a WhatsApped, Facebooked world. These days, we live in a world where on social media, we all want to go viral. Now, the virus is having the last laugh. But Dr. Kang is optimistic.
If you look at where we are, we got the sequence at the beginning of January. And 2 weeks ago, a company called Moderna in the US announced that they have the first vaccine candidate.
Even Milena's Uber driver had a workaround.
Then he asked me for 30 rupees extra and he would turn on the AC.
Meanwhile, India is not taking chances. The Calcutta Club in Kolkata had planned a talk to educate its members about the virus. Last I heard, the talk on corona was cancelled because of fears of corona. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns assesses social distancing.
My high school friend Ira planned an important road trip with his daughter Sophie in March. To get where they needed to go, they had to pass through the Hudson Valley where I live. Now he and I really enjoy each other, and he's never met my husband Barry, so we planned to get together at my house. We decided they'd stop and eat a home-cooked lunch on their way back home to Pennsylvania. That was our plan. Ira and I were pretty excited. You see, we caught the nostalgia buzz that's trending among others in our high school class. So, we were really feeling it. Then, the World Health Organization announced the coronavirus pandemic. Governor Cuomo shut down the SUNY system. He banned large gatherings, which shuttered Broadway, the Met, and so many businesses and events. Social distancing is now the phrase of the day. And while everyone's heard about the absence of toilet paper in stores, what about the naked shelves at Trader Joe's or the empty bulk bins at the food co-op? It's like we've awakened in a brand new world, and all the rules are different. After the huge, horrible news was announced, like everyone else, I had to deal with a million priorities. When I finally got around to thinking about the weekend lunch date, I wondered, should I cancel it? My first thought was, no, the rules for banning people apply to gatherings over 500. Ira, Sophie, Barry, and I make four. We could still meet. It wouldn't violate the ban. You can't live in a bubble, I reasoned. And then again, I reasoned that maybe we need to live in a bubble. So I thought more deeply about it. Ira and Sophie were going to come into our home. I figured we could disinfect after they left, but would that be enough? And then there's this. What if we have the virus and serve them food? The last thing I want to be is the typhoid Jerry for their family if my husband and I are unknowingly positive. It became patently clear that the rules of engagement have changed, and I mean that in every sense of the phrase. But what clinched the decision for me was thinking beyond our own situation and what could happen to four people. I started thinking about what that could mean beyond us, what it could mean for all those who we put at risk, for the greater community, family, friends, and strangers alike. The decision was now a no-brainer. We couldn't host them here. There was no question about it. But this was early days in the pandemic, just 2 days after the WHO announcement. And so I found the next step in this process surprisingly hard. I had to take back the invitation. It felt so wrong to do that, but then again, it felt so right. As I composed the text message, I cried. I was afraid of Ira's reaction. I mean, what if he thinks I'm being overly anxious? Well, truth be told, I am more anxious than chill when it comes to situations like this, but maybe I was overthinking or being overly worried. But then I realized, no, I wasn't crying so much in anticipation of his response to my anxiety. I was crying because everything had changed. And at that moment, it really hit me just how much. How an everyday activity like having lunch with a friend is now a potentially sinister, if not deadly, endeavor. I was crying because I was in mourning. I was mourning all the losses. I was mourning losses like college seniors' 4-year buildup to amazing final projects and graduation. I was mourning losses for businesses, for families, for losses yet to come. But I was mostly mourning at that moment in time the loss of normalcy. After I dried my tears, I sent the text. And Ira understood, of course, because good friends do. Then we came up with an alternative. We decided to meet at the local conservation area and walk to the neighborhood waterfall. When we finally met up, we all connected spirit to spirit, but at a social distance from each other. We were in the same forest, reconnecting with nature, at a social distance from each other. We crunched the leaves underfoot at a social distance. We took pictures also at a social distance. Ira and I stood far, far apart, and the rushing waterfall in the background made a beautiful watery boundary between us. By skipping lunch and taking a walk outside, we preserved balance and joy for a short, precious moment in a time of terrible trauma. Now, news and social media are filled these days with terrifying headlines, dire predictions, and horrible visions of the corpocalypse. While I need to stay aware and savvy, I can't dwell in that dark place all the time. A steady diet of fear increases my stress, and that could wreak havoc on my immune system. So when it comes to the worst of the worst scenarios, for the sake of my physical and emotional health, I need to keep a healthy social distance. Of course, I will continue to scrub my hands, wipe down surfaces, avoid touching my face, and keep my social distance. I will do my best to adapt to the changing rules of engagement and be a caring, thoughtful person in the community. I will acknowledge what I'm grateful for every day and find new ways to have joy. Or else, what is it all for? As for another get-together with Ira, well, maybe we can meet over dinner on a video conferencing platform. Instead of setting places for extra people at the table, my husband and I can prop up the laptop next to the kale souffle. And then we can virtually share food, wine, and friendship. And I can finally, finally get to meet Ira's wife. Stay safe, everyone.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1601.